weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world.
Okay, welcome to a new episode of Weather Realness here from Illinois Public Media and the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. I'm Steve Nesbitt, professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences and the department head.
And I'm Trent Ford, state climatologist at the Prairie Research Institute.
And I'm Jeff Frame, a professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences.
Today we're excited to have Climate Resilience Extension Specialist Jessica Rudnick from the University of Illinois Extension. She's based in Chicago. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi, Steve. Trent, Jeff, thanks for having me.
Climate change is coming at American family finance.
Global efforts to limit.
Climate change is affecting all of us, primarily through supersizing our extreme weather.
Actually, Illinois seeing the most tornadoes of anywhere in the country as the climate warms.
So today we're dealing with a topic that is sure to raise everyone's cortisol levels, thinking about how people deal with weather and climate from a regular person's perspective, but then also from the professional's perspective. So Jessica, first question, what is climate anxiety and what does that look like for someone going through it?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we all can imagine different forms of anxiety. We know that climate change and climate impacts can bring on these anxious feelings, and that presents in different forms. Sometimes it feels like grief or fear or worry or anger. These are all emotions that are part of our nervous system response when we sense threats. Climate change does this because we feel that we're threatened by the state of our natural world and what we can do about it. We often, when we think about anxiety, think about the fight or flight response. The third one that's often not talked about as much is freeze. And in climate anxiety space, we see this a lot where people become so overwhelmed with the feelings of helplessness or hopelessness around climate change that we end up in a freeze response where we don't know what to do. We're sort of paralyzed by that overwhelm. And we know that people can experience climate anxiety who have not been experienced a direct trauma or traumatic event like a climate catastrophe or an extreme weather event or a really damaging storm. But we also see a lot of acute response and severe mental health impacts with folks who have gone through those extreme weather events exacerbated by climate.
How is climate anxiety different from general anxiety, Jessica?
Yeah, so I think climate anxiety often piles on top of all of the other anxieties that we all experience in our day-to-day lives. So, you know, we have a number of chronic stressors, and that varies by people's identities and livelihoods and family and housing situations. And climate change can add to that. It can also exacerbate those different stressors. So we know that climate can exacerbate housing stress for folks who might not have air conditioning or heat and are going through some of those hotter heat waves in the summer and colder extremes in the winter. When we see air quality concerns, if you don't have easy access to indoor environments or you work outside, the stress that can come from those outdoor labor jobs can be compounded with the climate stress of exposure to, you know, poor air quality or wildfire smoke. So in a lot of ways, climate anxiety can heighten some of the stresses that we see in other parts of our lives. As I mentioned before, we also know that folks who live through extreme weather events and climate crises have, research shows, have more acute mental health stresses following those events. It can result in depression. We see more instances of PTSD symptoms or post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. among people who have experienced really severe and scary climate crises. And these symptoms can last a long time. So even if the event itself has ended, that sort of mental health toll can persist for a long time. We shouldn't really treat climate anxiety any differently than any of the other stressors that we know people struggle with.
And as an example of this, this also extends to weather disasters as well.
Hurricane Harvey, it is hammering Southeast Texas this morning.
So I heard, for example, in Houston, after Hurricane Harvey flooded a lot of the city back in 2017, there were some folks who lived there that, you know, after Harvey and things were cleaned up, that every time it rained, you know, and they weren't even expecting flooding, just general everyday rain, that they would experience a form of PTSD. And so I've heard of that. And
Yeah. So that's like what we call a trauma response. When you experience a trauma and then have survived that and then are in a new day, a different state, and you are triggered by something that feels like what you experienced before. And it actually is a cognitive neurological response in our brain that happens in the amygdala, which is the part of our brain that is like the emotional processing space. And it's our like evolutionary brain. So it is that fight or flight response. And so when you're triggered by that event that looks like what you experienced before, that amygdala can take over your processing, and the response is supposed to help you survive that event that you know was really scary, hard, damaging in the past. And so we kind of re-experience some of those things by going through that almost automatic response to what that stimulus is.
Yeah, so general anxiety, you know, this has been widely noted for a long time. Climate anxiety is something that's really seemingly gotten a lot more attention in recent years. So I guess, why do you think that is? And then how important is it to acknowledge climate anxiety versus like what you just talked about, all the other, you know, sources of anxiety we run into?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're learning the toll that climate change can have on people's physical and mental health. We've seen a lot more willingness to talk about mental and cognitive health sort of writ large. And so I think that applies here as well, that we're paying more attention to the mental health impacts that climate change can have. And we sort of as a society learned more of a vocabulary to describe those impacts and recognize and be able to, recognize and diagnose and help folks find care when they are experiencing those feelings. We're also experiencing more extreme events, and the impacts of climate change are more and more close to people. Like, they're hitting closer to home. They are occurring across the U.S. and around the world. We see them in many different forms, and so many people have experienced an extreme event themselves or have known someone to go through that in a, you know, pretty scary way. And we see a lot of the sort of overwhelming media coverage of these extreme events. And so I think all of these can contribute to more recognition of this phenomenon and more likely experiences that sort of trigger these anxiety responses.
And it sounds like there's some overlap here between, you know, these climate anxieties and some, you know, just other weather fears as well. I remember growing up in Michigan when I was a kid, and, you know, Michigan's part of the Midwest, so again, no stranger to severe weather in the spring and summer. I would be, you know, scared of thunderstorms, especially at night, right, you know, when mom and dad are asleep and all those things. And then eventually I grew out of it when I was about 10 or 11 years old, but some people haven't. And that's called astrophobia, a fear of thunderstorms. And I know that affects some people here in Illinois. And just a couple weeks ago, the National Weather Service in Lincoln hosted a webinar to help folks with storm anxiety. And again, that, you know, climate or no climate, right, that's still a thing. Thunderstorms have always been around. So For people experiencing these anxieties, what coping strategies have you seen that actually help?
Yeah, so again, I'll preface with I'm not a mental health professional or, psychologist or
Well,
a
neither are
medical
we.
professional. So just want to disclose that. So I am always an advocate of seeking care for folks who feel like they need it. I think always self-care is important, and that can help with emotional regulation, it can help with our nervous system regulation. It's an active choice to choose to give yourself emotional breaks and involve do the activities that help bring you relaxation and peace of mind. So sometimes for me, that means I choose to not check the weather every day, especially in those more stressful times of year. Or don't look at media stories of extreme weather events if I'm feeling like pretty overwhelmed with my own emotions around climate change. We also know there's a lot of research and a growing amount of research that being in nature and even looking at pictures of the natural world can bring about relaxation responses and can really help people to navigate some of those climate fears. So when we teach our climate resilience courses, we try to recommend that people take a walk, go outside, do some, discussion exercises outdoors, because we know that helps to, regulate the nervous system. I also know that we're seeing, people talk, the ability to talk about it, like voice those fears and concerns, especially with peers who understand and can relate. Learning about the risks, so sort of guarding yourself with more information and knowledge about where the extreme events are most likely, what times of year, what protective behaviors you can take, and getting involved with a local climate solution. So that can really help the feeling of that helplessness to have something that you can work on, and especially collectively with others. Can bring about feelings of empowerment and taking more control, and that has a pretty widespread effect across a lot of our different emotions. For storm anxiety specifically, I think maybe referencing the weather station's recommendations. I mean, again, we know like being prepared ahead of time, making sure you have a storm preparedness and response plan can help soothe some of those anxieties. Some of that can look like understanding more about what disaster relief resources and hazard preparedness plans your city or county or town have in place, so that you have a better understanding of what sort of community level response will be there for you. It can involve talking to your neighbors and making sure if you're worried about an upcoming storm, that you have sort of a backup plan if something were to go wrong in your own home or where you stay, that you have a place to go, you have an alternative if you were to, experience a lot of damage or lose power or clean water. You know what to do next so that you're not caught sort of in that flat-footed, unsure where to go.
You're listening to Weather Realness, a podcast about weather and climate in Illinois. I'm Steve Nesbitt, professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences, and we're joined by Jeff Frame and Trent Ford from the University of Illinois, and we're happy to have Jessica Rudnick here, Climate Resilient Extension Specialist at the University of Illinois Extension based in Chicago. So turning it over to my co-hosts here, of course, Jeff and Trent, we're professional meteorologists and climate scientists that help train students at the university, et cetera. And certainly we are both aware of the research in terms of, what kind of impact storms can have. And of course, looking ahead towards climate change, we're familiar with some of the potential impacts on people. And especially for meteorologists, oftentimes we're sitting in the hot seat, in a public safety role, telling people what's about to happen. That certainly raises a level of anxiety when you're issuing things like tornado warnings. And of course, there's the forecast, but then also thinking about the aftermath. So, Jeff, what are some ways that meteorologists, and then I'll turn it over to Trent, what are some of the ways that we feel anxiety about our professional roles in this field?
Yeah, sure. Great question, Steve. So, for example, warning forecasters at the National Weather Service will sit, you know, in a seat at the office analyzing radar data and issuing these severe thunderstorm or tornado warnings, sometimes for a period of few or even several hours, and they may not be the only person in that office doing that. Usually they're working with other people. It's really a team effort, but it fundamentally does usually come down to one person who, you know, hits the button, so to speak, and decides to issue the tornado warning. Now, they don't actually hit a button, but it's fun to think of it that way. And the decision-making process that goes into that, of course, for example, if you were to issue a tornado warning, it's not just, oh, a tornado warning goes out and, you know, the TV might interrupt some sporting event or something. But that also means, you know, the sirens are going to go off wherever that warning is issued for. It also means now everybody's cell phone is going to beep with an alert. And then if you do that in the middle of the night, of course, well, you're going to be waking up a bunch of people, or hospitals need to take their contingency plans and move patients into the hallways, and schools need to do their preparedness things. And so there's, you know, some fear of not wanting to issue the false alarm or be the boy who cried wolf. But if you look at the other side of things, what's called a missed event, in that a tornado happens and there's no warning for it, well, that is far worse societally, that you have folks now who might be facing a tornado or some other kind of severe weather with no warning. And that, of course, sets up folks, you know, for maybe more adverse outcomes to that event. So there's a double-edged sword there, and that's why the practice is to err on the side of a false alarm. That is, err on the side of issuing the warning. Even though a tornado might not happen, it's a lot better than having there be a tornado and having it be unwarned.
Yeah, so over a long severe weather event where you're issuing many, many warnings, this can obviously lead to a lot of stress, and kind of similar to an air traffic controller, you've got people's lives in your hands and then you just walk off a shift and, you know, in many ways we're just expected to just go on with our lives, but obviously that can build up. Trent, right. what about for a climate scientist thinking about the future?
Yeah, you know, it's obviously, it's less of an emergency situation with climate science. When we think about the future, or just planning for potential future events, or communicating what happened in the past events, with climate and climate change, there's always this balance to strike between proper information and informing with a great deal of uncertainty. So Jeff mentioned, like, trying to predict these on relatively short timescales and under emergency situations, something that is uncertain, perhaps. And that uncertainty with climate change, of course, is, or climate projections out, you know, 10 years or 100 years is amplified. So there's that part of it, trying to properly inform people and get folks' attention, because, you know, when there's a tornado warning and you have folks' attention, it's just a matter of getting them the right information. When it comes to climate change, there is that aspect of disinterest or indifference, perhaps, because it is hard to imagine what storms look like in the year 2050 or what heat waves look like in 2050, let alone trying to allocate resources to do something about it. And so there is this kind of balance where you're trying to inform and get folks' attention to say, this is a problem. This is a challenge. This is an issue. We're already seeing people die because of heat waves. Now these things are getting worse. But at the same time, also making sure that we don't inspire kind of paralysis because of just scaring the pants off of people, or skepticism, right? If you make things look so bad, it could just be skepticism. Or making that anxiety that Jess has talked about worse, which of course the anxiety and paralysis kind of go hand in hand. And so that balance is really important. Of course, it goes to the art of communication, which is knowing the audience. So if it's a public audience and you're just trying to inform, I have increasingly gone to every every slide that I'm informing and perhaps alerting to potential issues with climate change, I have a second slide that, or second point of information that is action, what you can do about it. And I can go through all my talks in PowerPoint or Canva and say, if I have 10 slides that could get somebody worried, I at least have to have 10 slides that can inspire action. And 6 years ago, when I started this job, it wasn't that way. It was like 20 slides of fear and maybe two slides of, yeah, here's what you can do about it. And so that's been a big shift. When it comes to things like informing public officials and emergency managers, that's where we can start getting into a little bit more of the, hey, like, let's do some scenario planning where, like, if this were to happen, what would you do? And not to say that we're going to have this massive heat wave over the city of Chicago that makes 1995 look like it was nothing. But let's say that we did. What could you do? What would be your actions? And in that way, we could talk about the really bad things that could happen, still really unlikely, but could happen, but in a way that could inspire action. And that would be a different conversation than you'd have with the general public or like a K through 12 classroom. What gives you confidence in our ability as a society to adapt?
So we do a lot of research on how people can engage in decision making at the community or higher scales. So whether that's city, county, state, or national levels, that's what we mean when we think about participatory governance. How are people able to participate and inform decision making and structure the agendas that we have for different, policies or programs to move forward. So in a lot of those settings across scales, I think we see that when we draw more people into that decision-making space and give people a voice to help determine what they want to see in their own communities, we get a lot of creative ideas and innovation, and that comes through that sort of wide-reaching, diverse set of life experiences and knowledge coming together rather than solutions being driven only by top-down ideas, whether that's, just scientists or technical experts like ourselves driving the ideas or government driving the ideas. When we take more of a, engaging people, bringing local knowledge in and listening to what community members' priorities are and ideas for how to bring about the solutions to reach those priorities and solve our problems, we see a lot more creativity. And that gives me hope. And I say that because climate change, there's no silver bullet solution. There's no one size policy or program or technology that's going to solve it. I think we need a huge portfolio of tools and actions and technologies and policies that we use at all different scales to help us prepare for the future climate that we will be experiencing and mitigate the damages that come with some of the more extreme weather and storms that we already experience and know we will continue to experience. And we need to, learn how to li both live and also thrive in a warmer climate, which is inevitably where we are headed, regardless of how much, how much aggressive action we have to reduce additional warming, which is very important, and we still can prevent future damage. So it's not a just prepare for hotter and don't do anything about stopping, future. Greenhouse gas emissions that drive climate change. So that's all I think some of the hope that we get from bringing more people into those conversations is finding more creative, innovative approaches. And I also find a lot of hope when we see community response in the face of hardship. So, following extreme weather events and disasters, we see that people come together and they help each other move through that damage. They help each other recover. A lot of that strength comes from within the community. And, that federal or state response to provide the immediate disaster relief is super important.
What are the things that you are doing or hoping to do? Because I know you're relatively new with Extension. In Extension broadly, to help communicate climate change, but also work with this reality of climate anxiety around Illinois.
Yeah, thanks, Trent. I am new. I've been with Extension less than a year, but learning a lot from what all my creative colleagues are doing across the state. And I guess I'll share two things that we're really excited about. First is there's a new state law in Illinois that was passed in 2024 that requires climate change be taught in all public schools, grades K through 12. And I think that's exciting, and it gives a opportunity to equip our youth with the skills that they need to be able to both navigate the anxiety that comes with climate change and be the leaders that are going to show us a new, transform our communities, economy, industry into a climate-friendly, climate-forward society. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity for Extension to work with our public schools across the state and help educators do that work and meet this new requirement with good science, good evidence, but also really good communication approaches, strong, tangible actions that they can help their students learn how to take and practice as they move through school so that they are equipped and have the skill set and are ready and are excited to do that work as they move out into the working world. And so we're offering some courses for teachers to learn how to do that climate communication, and we're hoping to work with the schools closely to develop some of that curricula. And the one other area that I'll highlight is that we are really excited about looking at community-driven resilience solutions and how that can be shared more effectively across towns and counties around the state so that we can learn from peers and see, like, what's the next county over? What's a town that's similar sized and dealing with similar challenges doing that I might not otherwise talk to, but I can learn a lot from? And so we are working on trying to build that government to government sharing network, and that allows for some of those more creative local scale solutions to be replicated in different places. And also, from a research standpoint, we can test and see what is effective for mitigating some of the climate damages fit on the physical landscape, and how those projects can help the communities respond to some of these behavioral and social and psychological effects of climate change.
Jessica, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate in Illinois. I'm Steve Nesbitt, professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences in the University of Illinois.
I'm Trent Ford, state climatologist at Base of the Prairie Research Institute.
And I'm Jeff Frame, professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences.
Have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu.